In the lead up to Wednesday's inauguration, law enforcement in Washington, D.C. are preparing for the worst.
There's a great deal of very concerning chatter, and it's what you don't know that we are preparing for.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Tuesday, January 19th, a look at how Washington, D.C. is responding to threats after the right-wing insurrection on January 6th. Then, could a program in Eugene, Oregon be a model for how to reform U.S. policing? And we round out the show by talking about the anti-racist books that flew off the shelves after this summer's racial justice uprising. But first, we start with a look at how the COVID-19 vaccine rollout in Chicago is going, and we're joined by Mayor Lori Lightfoot. As the COVID-19 pandemic continues to overwhelm communities across the United States, the latest forecasts from the CDC predict a dire situation in the weeks ahead. The nationwide death toll hovers at about 400,000, a grim milestone that's close to surpassing the number of Americans that died during all of World War II. The vaccine rollout that began at the end of last year was supposed to offer relief, but so far vaccine distribution has seen major delays in most parts of the country. And that's something the Biden-Harris administration says they plan to address. Here's President-elect Joe Biden last week.
We're going to make sure state and local officials know how much supply they'll be getting and when they can expect to get it so they can plan. Right now, we're hearing that they can't plan because they don't know how much supply of vaccines they can expect and what time frame. That stops when we're in office.
We've been checking in with local leaders nationwide about all this, and today we go to Chicago, where vaccine eligibility has been expanded beyond healthcare workers and long-term care residents to anyone over 65 who lives or works in the city. But at the moment, Chicago's rollout has been so slow that the city's mayor, Lori Lightfoot, says it will take a year and a half to vaccinate the entire city unless the process is dramatically sped up. To get a better sense of what's causing Chicago's delays and how the city is planning to improve its vaccination process going forward, I got Mayor Lightfoot on the line.
This is just a very basic issue of supply. We do not have enough vaccine from the federal government. We are dependent upon them, not surprisingly, to get the vaccine. And every week that we've been up and had our infrastructure clicking into gear, we've gotten less first doses instead of more first doses. That is fundamentally a problem. I've been very outspoken about this issue. I will continue to be as the change of administration comes into play. But we simply don't have enough first dose vaccines, and it's holding us back in our ability to get vaccines out to those people who are ready, willing, and able and enthusiastic about getting the vaccine.
We've been talking to mayors across the country, Mayor Lightfoot, about what they need from state and or federal officials. Is there something specific? You said you need more vaccine. Are there any other things that you need for the city of Chicago from the state or the federal government to move this process along more smoothly?
No, we're fortunate enough to get direct supply from the federal government. The one thing I will say about the state is we've identified for them that because healthcare workers in Chicago also live elsewhere, we've also been giving vaccine to a fair number of suburban residents, which is fine. But that means then we need to have backstop from the state and the county, and I think we will get there. But fundamentally, in addition to getting more first dose vaccines, we also need additional resources from the federal government to make sure that the infrastructure that we put in place has the resources it needs to be successful. We need more additional resources for staffing. And as we expand into more fixed sites across the city, looking at mobile sites, we just need more resources from the federal government. They had not allocated enough, even with the stimulus bill that passed at the end of December. More needs to be done, and I think the incoming Biden administration recognizes that necessity.
Mayor Lightfoot, you mentioned vaccine skepticism as being another hurdle that the city is facing in terms of getting people vaccinated. And we know that particularly for Black and Latino populations, that a history of racism within the medical community has also spurred concerns. Is there anything the city is doing or can do to combat that skepticism in those communities particularly?
Yeah, well, look, the skepticism, unfortunately, is widespread across the country. But what we started to do before we even got the first dose was to really lean into our trusted community stakeholders in the Black and Latinx community that we've formed partnerships with this entire past year since the pandemic came to Chicago. We've got a great network of partners at the local level through FQHCs, but also other stakeholders. But primarily what we're looking to is Black and Latinx healthcare workers, doctors, nurses, pharmacists. Those folks are really going to be, I think, the critical ambassadors as we continue to go hyper-local into these communities. If people see people who look like them, speak their language, getting the vaccine and explaining why it's important, that's going to make a substantial difference. And so we're leaning into those networks and those trusted community partners.
Mayor Lightfoot, as you know, one of the biggest tension points during the pandemic has also been the economic development or lack thereof of communities that have been forced to shut down. Restaurants and bars in Illinois have been closed for indoor dining since October after an order from the governor. You've been pushing for restaurants and bars to reopen. How would that look? How are you going to balance those efforts with the efforts to contain the spread of COVID-19 right now?
Well, look, I think you know this, but restaurants and bars are some of the most heavily regulated businesses in any city, and ours is no different. They have taken and invested a significant amount of their dollars to make their businesses safe, not only for patrons, but also for their employees. And what's become very clear is that because the bars and restaurants and other places of entertainment have been shut down, people have COVID fatigue, and they're seeking access to entertainment in other higher risk ways, underground parties, using hotel spaces, venues that should be closed. So what we're seeing is a lack of compliance that is placing residents more at risk. So I think that there's a public health reason why we should carefully reopen our bars and restaurants at limited indoor capacity, but there's also clearly an economic reason to do that. We're always going to lead with the science and the data, but what we are seeing across our city is that people haven't stopped congregating. They're just doing it, unfortunately, in more and more riskier, unregulated ways. We want to open up these regulated venues that are safer for people to congregate in and where we can have some oversight over what they're doing. And then also, obviously, opening up economic opportunities for our restaurants and bars and other entertainment venues that have been so hard hit over the course of this last 12 months.
Let's talk about schools, which is another important part of the COVID-19 recovery process here. Chicago schools opened for in-person teaching this month for the first time since the spring. And the Chicago School District is actually in the process, as you know, Mayor Lightfoot, of disciplining some of the teachers who chose not to return to the classroom. Where do you stand on that? What do you think is the right response for teachers who are concerned about their health versus sort of weighing this really tricky situation right now with the need to have in-person learning?
Well, I think first and foremost, we have to say we understand the concern and anxiety among some teachers. That's why we have done everything compliant with the ADA and obviously public health guidance to make sure that those teachers, for example, who themselves have underlying health conditions, have a waiver not to come back to in-person learning. For those teachers who are the primary caretakers of someone in their household who have the same kinds of challenges, waivers are granted for them as well. What we've seen over the course of this week that we've return to in-person learning for the first time in 300 days is increasing numbers of our school-based educators and staff coming back, over 70%+, and that number increases every single day. So I want to say thanks first and foremost to those teachers who were able to come back, who did come back. I went to schools this week. I saw the incredible joy and enthusiasm of our youngest learners because we opened up for pre-K and for our special needs kids. The parents who are grateful to have an option to come back. We're always going to provide that option. There are going to be some families for whom in-person learning is the best option. There are going to be some families for whom remote learning is the best option. But what I'm also concerned about is equity and making sure that we provide that option for parents and we do what we can now to close the equity gap and the achievement gap that we see growing exponentially over the course of this pandemic. We have to make up that ground. We're doing everything that we can, but in-person learning has to be one of the tools that's available for our school district, for our families, for our students, and of course, for our entire school community.
Mayor, I'd have to shift gears for a minute to a couple questions about criminal justice reform. The Illinois State Legislature just passed a piece of criminal justice legislation that eliminates cash bail for defendants and requires police officers to intervene if their colleagues use excessive force. Tell us about how you see this rolling out in the Chicago Police Department.
Well, many of the things that were identified as part of the package that eventually passed were things that we've been doing here in Chicago now for years, either voluntarily or because of our work under a consent decree. We worked hand in glove with members of the Black Caucus to help shape that legislation. And I think on balance, it's a very big step forward. There are things that we're going to need to look at. We may need to tweak some things around the edges, but on balance, this was a very important and monumental piece of legislation, and we're grateful for the leadership of the Illinois Black Caucus on it, and we will continue to work with them as we move forward on our journey that's not over on reform and accountability for not only the Chicago Police Department, but police departments across our entire state. I think that they showed tremendous leadership, and I'm grateful that they did.
Mayor Lightfoot, last month, a police video was released showing a February 2019 raid on the home of a Chicago resident named Anjanette Young. The officers made her stand naked with just a blanket wrapped around her body for about 40 minutes before they realized that they were in the wrong apartment. And you admitted that you had known about this incident for almost a year. What would you have done differently in that scenario? And what are some things that are being put in place now to make sure that those mistakes don't happen again?
Well, first and foremost, what happened to Anjanette Young was an absolute travesty. Those officers denied her her humanity that we are all entitled to. And so there's an internal investigation underway that will look at whether or not there's discipline that should be meted out to the officers and the supervisors that were involved in that wrong raid. But obviously that's not going to erase the pain and trauma that Ms. Young suffered. I had the opportunity to apologize to her directly on behalf of the city. And there's more work and healing that needs to be done. But let me be clear. What I knew about is that there was a local media outlet that was doing a series of reports on these wrong raids, and they reported about Ms. Young's case. That I knew. What I never saw until December of 2020, so almost a year and a half later, was a horrific video, and I saw it at the same time that members of the public did. Had I seen that video earlier, I would have taken the kind of action that we took, which was a fundamental reform of the search warrant process. There are a number of things that we did in response to that reporting that went into effect over a year ago in January of 2020. But importantly, when there is a wrong raid now, officers have an absolute obligation to report it so that an internal investigation can be opened up. I wish that had been in place at the time that this travesty happened to Ms. Young, but we've learned a lot from her circumstances and the circumstances of other victims for whom wrong raids happened, and we are moving forward aggressively to right those wrongs.
And Mayor, before we go, we are collectively in this country, from New York to Chicago to Los Angeles and across the world, really, we are facing some very dire moments. This pandemic seems to still not be letting up. Many constituents, I'm sure, of yours are struggling right now, whether that's emotionally, financially, or in any way at this point. Is there any room for optimism, Mayor Lightfoot, in the weeks and potentially months ahead?
Well, I think there's been optimism and opportunities all throughout this pandemic. And we just launched here in the city of Chicago our Year of Healing. And really, if you look at the way in which people in this city and across the country have stepped up, given of their time, their talent, their resources to help their neighbors in need, whether it's making sure that our seniors have a friendly voice on the other end of the phone, just checking in with them to make sure that they're doing okay and to address any needs that they have, whether it's a way in which people have stepped up to volunteer and donate to the many food banks so that we don't have hunger overwhelming our city and places all across the country, the way in which people have given resources to help support our small businesses by patronizing them, but also by donating to the various loan and grant funds that we have stood up here in the city of Chicago. There's a long list where people have seized this once-in-a-lifetime pandemic as an opportunity to reach out to their neighbors. And look, I would be remiss if I also didn't talk about the aftermath of the horrific murder of George Floyd, the death of Breonna Taylor, and so many others across the country at the hands of violence on the part of the police. This is an important inflection point for all of us. Yes, there is despair. Yes, there are moments where I have really had to be on my knees in prayer and really tears that have come to me, but what I've borne witness to in our city. But there's also so many opportunities for hope. And hope is what will get us through this and guide us out. There is light at the end of the tunnel with the vaccine, but we've got to have hope in our heart because that's it's a way that we're going to get through this. And that is what we need to exhibit to our children who are watching us and looking to us for leadership.
Mayor Lori Lightfoot is the mayor of Chicago. Mayor Lightfoot, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you for what you do.
Wednesday's presidential inauguration will be unlike any in modern history. In response to the violent mob that stormed the Capitol, local and federal law enforcement agencies have been ramping up security ahead of the inauguration. Currently, there are more than 25,000 National Guard troops in the nation's capital, multiple security checkpoints, and large-scale vetting of any military personnel on the scene. I'm joined now by Jenny Gathright, a reporter for WAMU in Washington, D.C. Jenny, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us what it looks like right now where you're on the ground.
Yeah, so there is a pretty intense security perimeter in downtown DC, which is, you know, there's about a 4.6 mile perimeter. And inside the perimeter, there's an extremely intense military and police presence. There are some checkpoints as you get closer to the U.S. Capitol on the National Mall, where you have to be searched by Secret Service if you want to proceed. And life inside that zone has been extremely disrupted for people. Roads are closed. It's really difficult to get around. Many businesses are closed. And then the effects are kind of rippling out, you know, beyond just people who live inside that zone to the broader city and affecting residents all over in different ways.
Are there specific measures that have been put into place other than the national? We know that there are 25,000 some odd National Guard troops on the ground. Is there anything else specifically that we know are local and other law enforcement agencies also there?
Yes. So there's a heavy law enforcement presence from NPD, which is our local DC police department. There also is a heavy presence from federal police. I saw, you know, people in uniforms from Bureau of Prisons police. I saw uniforms from Customs and Border Protection, and there are also, you know, police reinforcements from police departments out of town. So, yeah, there's a huge law enforcement presence. And like I said, you know, some of the measures extend just beyond that downtown area. Many of the bridges, as of this morning, that go into the city from Virginia and also go into the downtown areas from neighborhoods east of the Anacostia River in D.C. are closed, completely closed to traffic.
Jenny, is this in response to specific threats or is it largely a precautionary measure because of what happened at the Capitol?
The FBI has said, you know, in recent days that it's been monitoring online chatter and threats from far right, white supremacist and other extremist groups, you know, following the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol earlier this month. So far, no far-right gatherings have materialized in the city since January 6th, but, you know, local and federal officials say they're still on high alert. And yeah, this is largely kind of just in response to what happened on January 6th. And there's concern that, you know, small groups of people might, you know, continue to express their anger and try to, and those threats online might materialize into something. So folks are on high alert because of that.
We got one minute left in this part of the conversation. The mood in D.C. must be tense, but I'm imagining it also takes a long time to get from one side of town to the other. Is that what you're finding as well, given all these checkpoints?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that a lot of neighborhoods in the city that are farther from downtown, life is going on, you know, as normal. But for folks who are essential workers who have to get around the city to commute into their job, for delivery drivers, it's been really difficult to get around. And, you know, for those neighborhoods east of the Anacostia River, there's only one hospital and it doesn't have a maternity ward. So that means that, you know, if you go into labor, it could be possible that your quickest route to the hospital you plan to go to is now completely disrupted. So I think the ripple effects are real.
You were just saying that particularly for essential workers, women, people who might be about to give birth, there are real concerns about being able to navigate the city. What are you hearing from people in D.C. about how they feel about all this security around them right now?
Yeah, I mean, it's different from person to person. Many people say they understand why these measures are in place, but it is making their day-to-day life difficult, and it's exacerbating, you know, existing inequality in the city. I mean, DC has a large homeless population, for example, and many people experiencing homelessness who choose to stay outside of the shelter system, you know, they stay in parks and encampments that are in these downtown areas that fall inside the security perimeter. And, you know, outreach workers and mutual aid groups have been scrambling to get them resources and shelter because many of the homeless services have had to shut down because of the security measures. I'm also hearing from folks who are, you know, feeling, you know, like their life has really been disrupted. And there's a bit of resentment in the city over that because, you know, this is a city that overwhelmingly voted for Joe Biden. Many of the people who were involved in the insurrection largely came from out of town. And so I think there's a lot of resentment that, you know, about the disruption that the insurrection has caused for, you know, locals here.
And Jenny, you said that it's exacerbating a lot of the inequalities. One of the things about Washington, D.C. is, in fact, the stark inequality in our nation's capital, particularly among residents of color and Black residents. This could, you know, while the law enforcement there is there to protect folks, it could also heighten the opportunity for chances of law enforcement and residents of the city to come into contact, which is sometimes problematic, particularly if they're residents of color. How do Black residents feel about what's happening on the ground?
Yeah, I think there's sort of a twofold answer to that question. I have heard concern from Black and Brown people who live closer to this security perimeter, you know, who feel uncomfortable about this police and military presence. And, you know, they say it's kind of like there's two sides of the coin. You know, we face violence now in the city from far right and white supremacist groups. And then on the other hand, you know, this increased police presence isn't making them comfortable either. And then the other concern, you know, is that these neighborhoods east of the Anacostia River that are affected now by bridge closures, those are overwhelmingly Black neighborhoods, and some of the poorest neighborhoods in the city are over there. And I think people over there are feeling like, you know, why should we have to, you know, deal with the consequences of this when this is not a problem we created and it's really affecting our day-to-day lives now.
This is supposed to be a celebration of a new administration, particularly for those who voted for this administration. Is there any celebratory sense on the ground right now, or are things just really tense, Jenny?
It's definitely a mix. I mean, I spent as much of the day, you know, and over the weekend, you know, walking the city and talking to residents. And I did, you know, come across people who were trying to find their own ways to celebrate. I spoke with a Black woman who lives, you know, close to the U.S. Capitol. And she said she was going to try as hard as she could to get a glimpse of the ceremony because she was so excited about Kamala Harris being the vice president. But it's definitely a different vibe. I mean, you know, to contrast, President Obama's first inauguration brought 1.8 million people to the National Mall. And we knew that this year was going to be different because of the coronavirus. But, you know, one resident I spoke to put it pretty well. He said, you know, that was a time of celebration. This year, it's more about a feeling of relief at the end of the Trump presidency.
Couldn't add much more to that. Jenny Gathright is a reporter for WAMU in Washington, D.C. Jenny, thanks so much, and please stay safe this week.
Thank you for having me.
The archives at Carnegie Hall hold treasures from our cultural history. In the new podcast, If This Hall Could Talk, we use these items as touchstones to explore how the past shaped the world we live in today. I'm your host, Jessica Vosk, and I'll be joined by historians, performers, cultural critics, and others to look back at the iconic venue's legendary and sometimes quirky history. If This Hall Could Talk, from Carnegie Hall and distributed by WQXR. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
In many cities across the country, if you call 911 when someone is having a mental health crisis, it's the police who are most likely to show up. And as we've seen in well-publicized cases again and again, that can sometimes have disastrous results. Consider the case of Daniel Prude in Rochester, New York, who was asphyxiated by police and killed last March. His brother had called for help when Daniel was having a frightening mental health episode. But in the city of Eugene, Oregon, such a call would likely have been responded to by a group known as Crisis Assistance Helping Out on the Streets, or CAHOOTS. The program sends unarmed medics and crisis intervention workers to respond to a significant percentage of 911 calls instead of the police. Today, as our nation grapples with the urgency of police reform, Eugene, Oregon is getting renewed attention for the unique system, with some saying it represents the way of policing going forward. Joining me now is Rowan Moore Garrity, a journalist based in Phoenix, who wrote about this in The Atlantic. Rowan, thanks for being with us.
Great to be here.
So how does the program work, and is it affiliated at all with the police department, or is it completely independent?
So it is affiliated in the sense that it's a vendor that supplies services to the police department, but it is organized and operated by a community health clinic called Whitebird that's been in Eugene for more than 50 years. And so I think an important part of the sort of CAHOOTS equation is that even though they are dispatched through the police department and have pretty close working relationships with the police department because this service has been around since 1989, they are viewed by the whole city, and in particular by most of the people they interact with, as very much not police. And I think that's a huge part of what makes them good at their job and what makes them kind of a credible source of help in situations where people probably might not be thrilled to have the cops show up.
So there is so if someone calls 911, and what is it that the dispatcher is looking for in order to know whether or not to dispatch someone from this program known as CAHOOTS?
The biggest thing they're looking to make sure they don't hear is any reason to think that there's a weapon or another kind of physical safety risk that could be imminent. That's the sort of brightest line governing whether CAHOOTS responds or not is, is this a dangerous situation that the police will need to, you know, kind of verify or de-escalate before they can have someone else respond. But what they're looking for broadly, CAHOOTS responses kind of fall into three main buckets. Anything having to do with drug addiction or drug abuse, mental health issues, or homelessness. About two-thirds of their calls are first-party callers, so somebody calling on behalf of either themselves or somebody they're with. And about 60% of their calls have something to do with the unhoused population in Eugene. So that'll give you an idea. But they also do death notifications. They also do some kinds of domestic disputes. And so I think at this point, it's really a matter of trust. They've shown police dispatchers over 30 years that they're capable of helping people calm down in a variety of really high stakes, high pressure situations, and that in fact they're a, you know, very desirable alternative to the police response in those situations. And so I think police are quite eager to have CAHOOTS respond to a wide variety of calls.
Rowan, what is it? You've gone on calls with the folks from CAHOOTS. What is it like to be on a call with them?
It is mind-blowing, frankly. Just as someone who, you know, grew up in this country, and in most cities, right, you've got this sort of binary choice if you call 911, or the dispatcher does, which is, would you like police or fire? And having this third option is really striking to see in person. They're very calm. They're very focused on the person at the center of the call. So where, you know, if I call the police because I'm worried somebody's on my neighbor's lawn acting strangely, and the police come, the police are going to respond with a measure of concern for the person in my neighbor's lawn, but also with a measure of concern for, are there laws being broken here? Why did that gentleman call me? Is his home at risk? Is his property at risk? With CAHOOTS, it would really be, what does this person on the lawn need right now so that we can get them to a better situation? And when you see them working, you realize that in a lot of situations where the police are called, probably a similar thing goes on, which is that it's hectic, right? And so an important part of what that second CAHOOTS person might do while the first person, whether it's the medic or the intervention worker, is kind of engaging the person at the center of the call is figure out, hey, is there a dog I need to calm down so that they can have a productive conversation here? Is there somebody else who is sort of trying to get in the middle of this, who I need to deflect and redirect away from it? I ended up on one call on the story driving someone's car three blocks for CAHOOTS because I drove stick shift and they did not. And so a lot of what they do, that was a gentleman who needed to move his car in order to not violate a restraining order with his ex-girlfriend who lived where his car was parked. And, you know, so a lot of what they do just kind of falls into this hectic human problem solving thing. And I think that's something we all probably underrate as a share of 911 calls. You know, emergency kind of sends a narrower signal than probably the universe of 911 calls that come in most cities.
Rowan, we've got less than a minute to go, but I'm curious about how broad are there other police departments that are looking at potentially adapting something similar given the moment that we're in right now?
There's a huge amount of interest. When I was there in August, they had consulting or information requests from more than 300 cities. And I think what makes CAHOOTS appealing to a lot of cities, even places that have some other kind of specialized response unit within the police department, is the scale. CAHOOTS responds to somewhere like 17% of police dispatched calls in Eugene, and no one else comes close to even 1% in most American cities.
Going to have to leave it there. Rowan Moore Garrity is a journalist based in Phoenix, and he wrote about this program for The Atlantic. Rowan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Last summer, we saw an explosion in popularity of anti-racist books following the killing of George Floyd and subsequent protests against police brutality and systemic racism. From Ibram X. Kendi's How to Be an Anti-Racist to Robin DiAngelo's White Fragility to Ijeoma Oluyo's So You Want to Talk About Race, books about racism and anti-racism flew off the shelves at libraries and bookstores across the country as many people started grappling with the country's history of systemic racism, some for the first time. And you told us about it.
Hi, this is Wendy from Miami. Over the summer, I read How to Be an Anti-Racist by Ibram Kendi. I probably drove my family crazy because I walked around the house and read aloud to them out of the book, but I found it very valuable, and I really learned mostly that it's not about what's in your heart. It's not about not harboring hostile feelings toward people of other races. It's really about actively working to disassemble these systems that, you know, make people suffer unneedlessly. So I found it valuable, and I encourage other people to read the book, even if you disagree with it or pieces of it. It's really important to open your eyes, I think.
This is Polly from Connecticut, and two books that I've read in the past year are Waking Up White and White Fragility. Both of them didn't really speak to me as a white Anglo-Saxon American. The part that didn't really connect was that they are both about, you know, 20 years, a whole generation older than me, and I'm searching for a book that is written by a younger author who can relay experiences that I can understand that better because it's what I've lived or what I've seen in the news and in the world around me in my lifetime.
Here to talk all things anti-racist books are Catherine D. Morgan, a freelance writer and former bookseller at Powell's Books in Portland, Oregon. Catherine, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And also with us is Hannah Oliver Depp, owner of Loyalty Bookstores in Washington, D.C. and Silver Spring, Maryland. Hannah, welcome to the show.
Excited to be here. Thank you.
Catherine, why did we see such an overwhelming demand for these books? I mean, I guess that's an obvious question, right?
Yeah, it's like, I want to say a little bit, but I think that we saw an overwhelming demand for them, definitely because of George Floyd's death that happened in the beginning of the pandemic, or like in May, I believe. So not really beginning. But I think that we saw it because a lot of people had more time to read and they were able to witness the actual death that was occurring. And I think that people were finally starting to wake up and realize, like, that Black people weren't lying about police brutality in a weird way.
Hannah, you're literally in a bookstore. And first of all, I hope you're staying safe given all of the inaugural activities happening. But you own Loyalty Bookstores in Washington, D.C. and Silver Spring, Maryland. Did you start to notice a change in who was coming into your bookstore and what they were buying?
Well, we were actually at the beginning of this still closed. We are a non-essential business, and this is still fairly early on. We saw an uptick in these kinds of orders, which, you know, are the core business that we do at Loyalty anyway. These are the books that are the core backlist and frontlist titles. So at first, I honestly thought we were just getting an uptick in orders. This actually started for us around the time of the horrific murder of Ahmaud Arbery. And then that was followed in quick succession by George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. And so it became very clear that we were getting orders, not just from our immediate community in the DMV, but also getting orders from Colorado and California and Detroit. In some cases, we were actually pointing people to Black-owned businesses that they didn't know were there that they could support. Like, oh no, you have a Black bookstore in your town. It was a fairly sudden increase in orders from both people discovering that they had a bookstore in their town that they were excited about, and then also a lot of people asking how they could order from us, what was going on, were we open, were we not open. So it was definitely an increase, but also really complicated by the fact that we were actually shipping only at that point due to the pandemic.
And Catherine, you spoke to bookstore owners like Hannah for your piece in Literary Hub about this. Did you hear similar experiences to what Hannah's describing?
Yeah, I definitely heard similar experiences. A lot of bookstores that I talked to were very grateful for the uptick just because, you know, especially when the pandemic began, a lot of bookstores closed. They weren't open to selling to the public. And so a lot of bookstores were really grateful for the uptick because, you know, you had people who weren't necessarily just buying like one book or buying like a novelty item. They had people who were buying multiple books about the same subject. And so a lot of bookstores were feeling like this was keeping them afloat. I quoted one in the article I wrote where someone said that it kept them afloat all summer. So they were very grateful for the uptick. And
let me just interject there for a second. Hannah, was that the case for you? Did you notice that not just what people were buying more books, but that it was actually making a difference in your bottom line?
Yes, in the short term. One of the complicated things about book selling is because we don't have really a profit margin on our main item, which is books. Independent bookstores get a terrible discount from publishers. It's a much bigger story that we can go into. But due to that, it massively increased our cash flow, which was a godsend in the summer and rescued us entirely. We were still struggling to get Wrestle our PPP loan, actually. So I was able to bring some staff back because I had been working solo since March to try to keep the store afloat. So we were able to bring staff back. It was great.
Thank you, Hannah. Catherine, I'm curious, Were people buying these more in bookstores for a purpose? Did they want to support Black and Brown bookstore owners, or was it because they weren't able to find them on places like Amazon, or what was the bookstore connection?
I think a lot of times people were buying from Black-owned bookstores because it made sense to them, which, I mean, if you're going to buy a book about anti-racism, you should probably buy it from people who have experienced racism. So I think that Amazon, of course, was selling out of them as well, but I think people were really wanting to give back to their community and give back to people who were affected by the actual issues in the book.
Hannah, it's been a few months since the uprising over the summer for racial justice. Are you still seeing interest in these books?
Absolutely, yes. I think a lot of folks who discovered us over the summer have stayed with us, and they've gone from reading kind of one of the books they sort of vaguely heard about on Instagram to actually seeking out, you know, deeper reading on the matter. The volume has died down, but the folks who have committed are certainly actually committed. There's a dramatic drop that happened around August, September. But we certainly, and I've spoken to other bookstores, we certainly retained a good amount of interest, frankly, more than I was expecting. I had very low expectations of how many people were going to keep pursuing this.
I'm wondering, Hannah, also, if people go sort of as the entry point, using sort of an anti-racist book as maybe the entry point, both into your business and into the idea of anti-racism, and then perhaps come across other books by Black authors that have nothing to do with that, that are fiction, that are science fiction, that are, you know, nonfiction, and realize there's a whole other world of authors that they haven't even explored. Are you noticing that as well?
That's what we're trying. That's literally the point of the bookstore. Yes, we try to expose them to Black fantasy, Black joy, Black children's picture books. There is a whole world of Blackness that literally has been existing and whiteness has completely ignored. So it's really, really wonderful to be able to show people, oh, you love romance, you love fantasy, you love detective fiction. There's Black stories there too.
Catherine, what about you? You were a bookseller at the time. What was it like when you were interacting with customers? Did you feel like people were there to sort of, because they needed to be there, they felt pressured to be there, they had good intentions, but were somewhat confused? Like, tell me about that.
So when this all happened, I had actually been laid off from Powell's for a few months because of the pandemic. And so I was actually working for a company called bookshop.org. So all of my customer interactions were online. So it was all email based. So I had a very different experience dealing with customers, just because I felt like a lot of them were, a lot of customers were super understanding just because, you know, books were back ordered for a really long time just because of the push that was happening with the anti-racism books. And we were, like, when I was working at Powell's, we were selling, you know, quite a few of these anti-racism books. Like, White Fragility was really popular. Their author came to speak at Powell's, and it was a crowd of about 200 people. But for me, it was when I was dealing with the anti-racism books and what kind of inspired the article that I wrote for Lit Hub was the fact that, like, a lot of the customers were really kind, but I did have some customers who were very much, like, distraught about the fact that they couldn't find the books anywhere. And then when I tried to offer them other resources or offer them other titles or things like that, they didn't want to seem to take them just because they were like, well, I need this exact book for my book club. Like, what am I going to do? That kind of attitude. And I was like, well, I don't know. Just because I was like, well, if no one has the book, I was like, maybe you could ask a friend who has the book. Like, I was just kind of, it was just a confusing time because I was like, well, these books have been out for like a year or two
The book club is in high demand.
Yeah.
Hannah, what about, I mean, we're sort of assuming here that the majority of the people who are buying these books are not people of color, are not Black people who are buying books about how to be anti-racist. And I know with the understanding that a lot of this work was being done online, but I imagine that there are other groups of people of color who may also be wanting to know more about the struggle for Black liberation in the United States.
Absolutely. No, we saw a dramatic increase in white folks paying attention to this, but there was also deeper reading happening of people who either were already on their journey or perhaps hadn't really explored what Black liberation might mean for them on like a micro level within their community. So that was definitely happening. And, you know, the fact that we were doing this online a lot of the time complicated things. It made customer interactions much harder. People tend to fly off the handle a lot faster when they're talking to somebody over email or over a digital chat as opposed to face-to-face.
And were they also upset that they didn't have the books in time for the book club, or were there other issues?
Yes, there was a lot of, I actually had one woman tell me she can't fix racism if I don't get her this book, so I should work harder.
That's a big undertaking.
Yeah. She was single-handedly going to fix it by reading White Fragility, which is not actually what White Fragility is about. She definitely needed a copy, but there was definitely a disconnect in the desire to support Black businesses and understanding what that actually looks like in real life. We had a pandemic. Literally, books are still constantly backordered due to the pandemic and due to printing in the U.S. and internationally. And it's very, very hard to switch people over who are used to kind of thinking that there's just sort of a blob of customer service that's going to help them versus interacting with real people.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, Catherine, because I'm wondering if some of this is people saying, you know, well-intentioned people saying, I've got to do something, I've got to learn something about this, reaching out, getting the books for the book club in time. But it feels like that may not be enough. I mean, doesn't it have to be part of a broader commitment, or is just doing the reading, as we say online, enough?
I think that it has to be part of a broader conversation, just because I felt like a lot of times people would buy the books and, you know, not necessarily read them, or they would buy the books and read them, but they wouldn't put anything into practice. And so for me, it was kind of hard because I was like, okay, like you did the work, you started doing the work at least. And then it just kind of stopped there. And then I was like, well, are you, and like people would post like the black square on Instagram for like blackout day. And they were like, you know, I did something. And we were like, well, you didn't really do anything. Like, we need you to do more work. And then I felt like a lot of my, I even had people who were coming to me where they were just kind of like, oh, well, I did these two things. And I'm like, great. But like, you have to continue doing the work. Like, are you donating to charities? Are you, you know, are you getting involved with communities? Are you supporting Black owned businesses? Like, there's just so many steps that are involved with it, but I think it could be really overwhelming to people. And so I think that for a lot of people, you know, Black, white, whoever, a lot of people will just, like, they'll start the work and they'll feel good about it. And then once they realize that there's more work to be done, I don't think everyone fully is ready to commit to actually, like, what the undertaking of how to be anti-racism is.
Goes beyond the pages. Hannah Oliver Depp is the owner of Loyalty Bookstores in Washington, D.C. and Silver Spring, Maryland. And Catherine D. Morgan is a freelance writer and former bookseller at Powell's Books in Portland, Oregon. Catherine and Hannah, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having us.
All right, everybody, that's our show for today. We've got a big historic week coming up, and we're going to be back here tomorrow for a special edition of inauguration coverage, so please make sure to join us for that. If you want to share your thoughts, you can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253, or send us a voice memo. Record the memo into your phone and email it to us at takeawaycallers@gmail.com. We're looking for your thoughts on the inauguration tomorrow. What are you thinking? What are you feeling? Let us know what it means to you. We'll be hearing your takes tomorrow on the show. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll see you tomorrow.